Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to Coast, This Week in America. The 1960s in America brought to light the importance of civil rights. The 1970s drew into focus issues of tribal rights, equity, and justice through the Red Power Movement. It was at this turning point in American Indian history that a discourse of sovereignty and tribal self-determination gained national and worldwide visibility. The same era ushered in foundations of the hip-hop movement. Native peoples living in urban centers were exposed to this expressive complex and utilized the embedded resistant nature of hip-hop. The 1980s brought forth a critical native hip-hop voice that spoke across the lines of socio-political demarcation. The critically acclaimed Are You Still Ready for War? Without Reservations, Native Hip-Hop and Identity in the Music of War, WOR, by Alan Lechusa, Ph.D., focuses on the Native Hip-Hop group Without Reservation, WOR, and their use of the cultural signifiers and elements of hip-hop. Dr. Lechusa is a scholar whose name has been synonymous with critical thought and cultural discourse. He's a thinker and writer who explores the world of popular culture with a critical eye. He holds a Ph.D. and uses his deep, resource-rich understanding to question and redefine how we see art, power, and knowledge. And Dr. Alan Lechusa, author of Are You Still Ready for War, WOR, our guest on This Week in America. Dr. Lechusa, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Interesting topic. I love when we talk about pop culture, the importance that has on society all around us, and you are at the forefront of this discussion. The book is doing exceptionally well, opening eyes, giving us a different perspective, receiving rave reviews. What was it that inspired you to write about Native music?
Well, it started back when I was in grad school, actually. My program was really small and very intense. There was three of us in the program, and the way I like to say it is one of us graduated. we were talking about music and the importance of it at the time, because that's where the background, you know, was in. It was in the music and ethnic studies and critical theory. And one of my professors, I mentioned Native music in one of our sessions, and the professor brought up and said, well, why should we even discuss that? There's no reason to talk about Native music. And I articulated back and said, perfect, that's all I'm going to be talking about from here on out. And I went forward and took that, you know, took the bull by the horns, and just, it just really let it, you know, let it move forward from there. And my first writings were on rock and roll, Indian and rock and roll, the embedment and the interconnections between the two. And I just kind of, you know, continued to follow the thread and just let it lead itself and go where it needed to go.
And the result is this book. The book is available wherever books are sold. Alan Lechusa, Ph.D., our guest on the program. His website, alanlechusa.org. Lechusa is L-E-C-H-U-S-Z-A. We've got a direct link on our website, thisweekinamerica.us, so you can get there, get information on the book, his other book as well, and order both. How did you get involved with writing about the hip-hop culture? How did that whole thing come about?
Well, I was still in grad school, because I was there teaching at the time and finishing my PhD at the evolution of when hip-hop was really becoming an area of serious discourse and education, pedagogical practices. And my mentor teacher said, you know, we're assigning you to teach hip hop. And I looked at him and said, no, I don't want to have anything to do with that. And he kind of pushed back and said, this is going to be really good for you. This is something, you know, you need to do and to get into it. So the first time we launched the first classes there on the West Coast on hip hop, teaching it critically at the university where I was at. And so the first semester I was just the teaching assistant. And the instructor wanted to talk about Native hip hop. And he said, hey, you know, this is up your alley. This is what you do. He said, you know, I want you to read this article. And at the time, there's only one article, and it was very short, that was dealing with Native hip hop. And I told him I didn't want to lecture on it. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And he said, well, can you at least read it and give me some feedback? So I read the article, you know, per his request. And I came back to him and said, this is the most scandalous unabridged, racist, uninformed, article about it. I said, I have to talk about this because this author just doesn't know what he's talking about. And so from that point on, I developed a whole segment and curriculum around Native hip hop, teaching it and then forming it. And eventually, when I got my tenured professorship where I was at, I was able to, construct whole classes around Native music, with specifically focusing on Native hip hop and just, continue to let it, flourish and go from there. And it's something that just it gravitates to me, it pulls to me. I mean, it's when I was writing the my dissertation, which, became the book, it just, I couldn't get away from it. And it just I wasn't going to fight it at that point. It had such a gravitational pull, I needed to let it go and to see where it can manifest.
Let's talk about that poll and the book, which came out of the dissertation. What brought you to write about the specific topic and the specific group that we're talking about?
Well, at the time, there was like one individual that qualified, or that I should say, the pop culture qualified as being a native hip hop artist, and I disagreed, and I said, that's not true. I know that's not true. And in researching the guy's history, there was multiple native artists that I knew that were doing spoken word, they were doing slam poetry, that were involved with emceeing, DJing, break dancing. It was exclusively, it was in the culture, and so I argued against it, but I needed to find, who was it going to be. And since I was, situated on the left coast, on the West Coast, I wanted to see, well, this person is saying he's the individual. Is there a group? Who actually came to be the first collective of hip hop, for Native peoples? Because that's something that's very important coming out of the Bronx and such, the collectives, the groups that are there. It's not just, a single solo MC or DJ.
Yes.
And then war came up. That's without reservations. So this is like the early onset of internet. So it was, like pulling teeth to try to find out and how to get connections to the group. And eventually, I was able to get in hold with a hold of Chris Lamar, who's up in San Francisco at the time where he was at, and then up in more northern California, Susanville. And he and his associates, they're the ones that put the group together. So I reached out, interviewed them for the work, and then reached out to other native hip hop artists, photographers, break dancers, MCs, and such on the East Coast, and all across the country that I could get a hold of, and it just started to flourish. And when I introduced this group to them, they were shocked. A lot of people had not heard of them, so it really brought a lot of light to the group. It brought some attention to what was going on over here on the West Coast, and it showed, the definitely a strong root, for where Native hip hop was growing and going, that was even out of the proxy and parameters of the Native communities at the time.
What is so impressed you to write about Native hip hop? What is it that drew you to that? Because you are calling attention to this, and it's something that's fascinating when we look into it, but we really haven't seen a whole lot of writing on this except from you.
What was interesting about it is that at the time, when I was in my undergraduate and master's degree, I was also a powwow singer. So I was on the powwow circuit. So I was really immersed in the musical traditions, of our peoples, and traveling all over the place. I was either studying or I had my books under my seat, and we were singing, and like that was my life. And it really got hard when I went to doctor school. My uncles told me that, I was not allowed to sing anymore. So I gave it up for just my studies. And when I first got connected and heard, especially war, it was just the sounds of the powwow arena were back, and I could hear, what was going on. I could hear the emergence and the connection between the different cultures, between the pop culture, hip hop culture, and the native communities. I could hear the voice. I could hear the importance of the tribal, identity that was inside of it. It just all merged together, and it melded. And then the language, the way that the men and women, speak about, their issues and situations, and how they contextualize it social, politically, and tribally. It has such a rich history and content that's inside of there. But they're using the core elements and exploring them in some really interesting, and fascinating ways. So as the communities continue to progress and to develop their works in Canada, you know, and across the United States, you know, other elements of hip hop started to come in, you know, trap hop, house, you know, trip hip hop, you know, all these other ways that, that Native people were starting to utilize and take hold of these other genres and subgenres of hip hop and really expressing themselves. But it was also then the connection, because then I could speak to people who are Mexican, Mexican American, you know, Latinx. I could speak to people who were Jamaican. I could speak to people, you know, who are African. You know, really, I mean, all across, you know, the different cultures, because we had this commonality that was inside of it. It was the social discourse and the political resistance that hip hop was able to bring for us all to collect our voices in dialogue. So the differences were not there. It was really a common ground and a sense of unification that you know, you would see at some points, but for some reason, this really just brings it together. And then also the collecting, like I said, you know, dancing and emceeing, and you know, and the spin art, you know, the DJs that are involved with it, and just exploring all these different elements, but not losing your tribal identity. That was just so critical and core, because I watched it being washed away, you know, from other artists. Yes. But with tribal artists, I didn't. It's a strong retention point. The root is there.
When you were doing your background, when you became interested in this, when you were doing your background as you were researching and working on the book, are there many writings that you were able to find out there about Native American hip hop?
Well, like I said, at the time, there was only that one article, and it really was horrifying for me to read, as it just did no credit, and it was really just kind of, it was very much a strong discredit to what Native hip hop was trying to be, and its evolution. Since then, there's only been a couple of other books that have been done upon it. What's interesting about the work that I've done here is that this one's exclusively focusing on one group. And it focuses on, you know, the contextualization of how Native hip hop came out of, you know, the Bronx area. And it really kind of had its strong, you know, pull and relationship all throughout American, you know, pop culture and, you know, and the musical, you know, dialogues and parameters that were already in place before that, with funk and with, you know, with trip and with, you know, with disco and, you know, all the other elements that were coming up. And it just showed a nice steady progression for it. The other books and stuff that I've read on Native hip hop either explores a specific individual and contextualizes that one individual, or what they do is it's so overarching that it doesn't a grounding in one sensibility. So the work that I did, I really wanted to focus in and say, look, if we're going to be talking about this, we have to really contextualize and look at, you know, its core center. And we have to really kind of emerge and situate ourselves, you know, into where these roots connect, where's the evolution, how's it going, and it is for to inspire other Native yes. artists and writers and, you know, to come up and to be able to build off of this work and to go forward. That's what I wanted to see. So, and that's even with when I'm teaching it, I don't try to use a very essentialized, you know, kind of a sense, because in that case, the Indian and especially the Indian hip hop artist just becomes a token of pop culture. It just becomes another thing out there. And that's not the importance. And it's the Native artists that I work with and deal with and write about and discuss, you know, are very critical to what's going on, because that pulse has not gone away. The bloodline is still there. The heartbeat of the people is still going. And to discredit that or to turn away from it or to minimize it just doesn't do satisfaction to the work. So in African American communities, there's a body of work that's already there that's established. So taking a more generalized position doesn't take away from the credit of the foundations that's already there. For Native music to have something, we're still building it. It's in process still. So to have this canon start being, you know, developed and growing and manifesting, you know, in real time, it needs to have a very strong roots foundation. And that's what I like to provide. And besides when I'm, you know, writing about something and I pick up on it, like I wrote about a Canadian trip hop artist recently who's blind. And you know, when I was writing about his work, it's really centering in and focusing in and saying, what's him? What's his contribution? How is he connecting to his tribal cultures? You know, what's he doing to progress hip hop and the tribal communities? You know, how are all these areas intersecting together? And what's his music sound like? Is it really cool? I mean, can I just sit there and groove to it while I'm in the office and, you know, and working?
Yes.
Can I just put it on? And so I want to have all these elements come together so people realize there's a rich culture that's underpinning. There's something that's alive that's going on, and there's something that's a very serious critical importance here, you know, for Native peoples.
The book is Are You Still Ready for War? W-O-R, Without Reservations, Native Hip-Hop and Identity in the Music of War, W-O-R, by our guest on the program, Alan Lachusa, Ph.D. The book is available wherever books are sold. His website is his name. You'll find Alan Lachusa, that's LECHUSZA.org. And you can order the book there, get information on another book that is written there as well. So how did the group perceive your book? How was it received by them? Here's something that's new, especially to them, and they've got somebody paying attention to not just their music, but the roots of their music. How was it received by them?
We were all pleasantly surprised. It was like meeting your cousins that you knew you had, but you'd never met, you know, over such a long period of time. Because I had to set up multiple interviews with Chris Lamar. He and I have, you know, stayed connected, you know, even to today, you know, we still connect with each other. He was just shocked that somebody even knew about his work. And, you know, he wanted to know how I came about it. And I mentioned I only knew a few tracks of theirs, but I was, you know, so strongly, you know, pulled to it and inspired that I really wanted to focus on their work. And our interview times just really became more, you know, conversational, hangout times with each other. And, you know, and they were long, long hours we spent together. And eventually what I started seeing, because I asked him, I said, you know, do you have any other works? You know, all of a sudden one day I had a package at my doorstep, you know, from Chris of like, you know, other recordings that they'd done, you know, other things were unreleased, you know, garage tapes, you know, back when CDs were, you know, were still in, you know, being used and such, and unreleased stuff. And it was like a treasure trove. And he was just so excited to see that anybody had paid attention, that actually what they had done, because when I started writing about them, they'd only put out two records. And after the second one, they went on a very strong hiatus. And almost disbanding completely. They kept the name War Without Reservations, WR. They kept the name going and used it as like little projects that they were doing, but nothing of serious importance. Once we started talking and they you know gave me complete access to their complete library, all of it. The group and I were the only ones that had copies of it in the country. That was it.
Wow.
And they even had the original record company send me copies, you know, so that way I could have like the full recordings. Because like I said, I only had like two or three tracks at the time. So it was overwhelming for me to see. I was just so, so happy. And the group then actually started to explore their works again. They actually put out, you know, some subsequent recordings. They actually have a new one that's going to be coming out soon. The exact date, you know, I don't know about, you know, but I teased him and said, you know, hey, let me do the reviews of it, the writing of it, you know, to help inspire and encourage what's going on, because this would be something that they've had after at least a 20-year hiatus, you know.
Amazing.
But that means that the work is still there and it's still, you know, drawing attention, you know, over this time. And to see that, you know, that from me specifically to them is a compliment. It's like, I'm not giving up on your work. I really feel it's strong and encouraging. And what you're doing for the, especially for Indian youth right now, you know, what you're doing to connect with them is so important. You know, it brought them back to want to explore some new ideas, some new themes, you know, some new styles, and, you know, and see where it's going to go. But at the initial time, they were very, very excited. And like I said, our connections have just continued.
It's amazing the impact it has on them, the community, and listeners, people who enjoy music. Suddenly they have a different impression, interpretation of music as they're watching this group perform. Are you still active in writing about Native hip-hop? And who are some of the Native hip-hop artists, North American hip-hop artists?
Yeah, I write about it extensively. it's like I said, you know, I did an article recently on a Canadian trip hop artist who's blind. I was just kind of inspired by him.
Yes.
I mean, some of the big ones who come up, you know, Superman is kind of cool, you know, with what he does that's out there. I'm just drawing a blank with some of the other groups. I mean, Drazus I really like, but I gotta go back to like the core elements of it, with where it comes from. It's because the groups are talking. It's not just specifically one group, if I can put it that way.
Okay.
It's the fact that there's larger communities that are out there that are working. And what's exciting to me about it is seeing how many of the artists are exploring groups that employ like a gangster culture, and then they integrate that, or that they'll explore a mestizo culture and they'll explore that, or they'll specifically, you know, want to talk about, you know, their work, you know, directly. Like I mentioned, Drazus, one of his pieces, Red Winter, is just, it's captivating and stunning because it comes up with the flash powwow movements that were coming up at the time, where there was powwows that would just show up across the world for, like, you know, out of nowhere, like when those flash mobs were happening. And they did it for flash powwows to set up as a site of resistance and, you know, and perspective for what was happening. And that was just, you know, very, very exciting to see, you know, and how he explored that and talking about, you know, social political justice for them. Natie Means, he's another guy, and, you know, and his songs like Warrior, you know, are very, very, very strong, you know, to come up. And he's the son of Russell Means, who I got to interview
Oh,
for my
yes.
book as well when he was still alive. Yeah, I tracked him down and spent 2 days with Russell Means, and at this time, and his son Natie, you know, he's really involved with hip hop and graffiti culture stuff, and he's, you know, does it very, very strong there, you know, on his reservation. Here on the West Coast, you know, there's a lot of slam artists that I'm starting to talk with around, and because they're emerging, emceeing as well as, you know, slam poetry. So a lot of the cats from like the Bay Area and the Fresno area that I'm working with and talking to, there's some breakdancers. Like there was a Anita Breakdance Collective that happened in the UNM, University of New Mexico. It was taking place that brought together and employed a lot of underground native hip hop artists. So, like I said, it's not just any particular one, it's an embodiment of it. And what's very interesting, exciting for me is seeing then how the native women are getting involved with it. Like there's an article I'm writing right now for an Indian college journal. And I just interviewed the other day a native MC, a lady MC, which is so exciting for me to talk to and to hear, you know, her and her connection to it, and wanting to talk about, you know, the relevance of MCing DJ culture and her slam poetry that she presents, and how she brings in the elements of powwowing. She brings in the elements of her traditional culture as well as the elements of hip hop and embraces them all together. But her degree is in social welfare and social work. So she's a social worker doing this at the same time. So like I said, it's all these different areas that are coming together. So it's not just specifically like a artist. And I think that's what becomes the difficulty with this. People want to like say, you know, okay, who is it that I can point to? Who's like the one person? And that was a problem that I saw early on, was that Native people are not a token. They're not a stereotype or a compartmentalized, you know, localized trope for American pop psychology. It doesn't work like that. Is that, you know, we all are thriving, you know, peoples, and from all these different nations across, you know, the North American continent, and we all have these different ways of exploring and investigating how these different cultural ramifications work for us as identity formation and construction. And so when I'm looking for things, it's not like I'm trying to target or look and single out one entity or one person.
Right.
It's I'm trying to look at, you know, what's the larger connection to it in the fabric, and how can these different voices then connect to each other to show that, hey, this network is alive and thriving.
You know, it's interesting. You've said that you your goal that you would like to accomplish to create conversations that inspire change to understand how we experience the world, and you're doing that with this book. We're rapidly running out of time. What do you hope the takeaway is when someone reads this book? What do you hope they see? What do you hope they take with them after they've completed reading it?
I would hope that the reader, first of all, is like stunned that they hadn't seen it before.
Yes.
Encouraged to move on and to explore the different things. That's why in this updated version of it, I include the bonus tracks where I have an abundance of newer resources that come up. So I actually interrogate the old scholarship and revise it. So the reader gets the older content that I originally did, and then they get to see the updated adaptations to it and where it's gone since then. So I want them to explore those relevance in there so that they start understanding language revitalization, you know, self-determination, the right of sovereignty for Native people. What do these things really mean? You know, being inspired to kind of, you know, just put aside any of the stereotypes or predetermined, you know, conceptions that they have about Native people, and seeing, you know, what are the open natures that are available to them that are there, but really to be encouraged by it, really to start stretching out, really to be wanting to reach out and to see what's going on and to, you know, involve themselves with some of those resources, like I said, that I've already included, and just to really kind of give a fair shake and a hand to say, you know, this is something I didn't see before. What's it all about? And so, as my tagline says on my blog sites, you know, let's talk about it.
Well, you begin the conversation, you give us a new perspective, a thought-provoking book, Are You Still Ready for War? WOR. Without Reservations, Native Hip Hop and Identity in the Music of War, WOR, by Alan Lechusa, our guest on the program, PhD. Lechusa, if you're going to Google, is Lechusza. His website is alanlechusa.org. Those links on our website, thisweekinamerica.us, book available, of course, wherever books are sold, directed to Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Direct links on our website, as I say, to Dr. Lechusa's website to get more information there. What are you working on now?
What am I working on now? Like I said, I have a nice article that I'm doing on emceeing and Indian pedagogy for a tribal journal that'll be coming out in March. So I'm focusing on that. So I have a bunch of interviews that are set up on my own, you know, where I'm talking with different Native MCs and DJs up and down California, and that one will be going out. I'm looking at exploring. I have what I call my VIT, the Virtual Indian Tribe. It's a Facebook group that I got started, where it opens up and explores like all these different intersections of tribal identity and pop culture. So I got that that's going, and I write, you know, extensively about that and the different issues that are happening. Even today, I was just looking at a bunch of the collective news from across Native America, and just saying, okay, it's time for the next article to come out. So, you know, I pump out stuff every day. You know, I'm writing articles consistently on my Substack and my Medium accounts and my Pothos accounts that deal with it. So I'm writing, you know, about pop culture, you know, all the time, writing about the current Native issues that are happening, and, you know, and how we can utilize it as a pedagogical practice, but then also as a intersection for these different communities to come together, to sit down, to have a really strong, honest conversation, put differences aside, and just see how it is that we can all jam together to the same beat, because that's what we're really doing at the end of the day.
Well said. I really appreciate you taking the time to spend the talk with us about this book. Hopefully we can do it again. So much more in the world of pop culture, and we'll look at it differently and see the impression that makes us on us as we do that. And the book, again, available wherever books are sold. Dr. Lechusa, thank you for being with us on the program.
I so appreciate it. Thank you so much. I encourage everybody to, you know, to check out the stuff.
That's it for today's program. You're listening to This Week in America, back after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.